Welcome to the Echo Effect podcast series, where we unravel the intricate interplay between war and environment through engaging and thought-provoking conversations. The series is created and moderated by Inés Montalbán, Program Director at Artists with Evidence, who is joined by two featured speakers, transmedia artist and curator Ali Akbar Mehta, and distinguished poet and humanist Colin Greer. With a constellation of insightful guests, we will delve into critical issues such as climate change, resource scarcity, mass migration, and democratic erosion, as well as other unexpected topics that intertwine with war and environment in unforeseen ways. Echo Effect, Conversations on War and Environment, is a program funded by the Nordic Culture Fund, who awarded Artists with Evidence with the Globus Upstart Grant for 2024.
I think that if everyone agrees, we can start the conversation. So I'd like to start by welcoming everyone who's joining the fourth conversation of Echo Effect. We are today, our topic is for a secure future, ending the nuclear threat. And today I have with me, as usual, Colin Greer, one of our speakers. Today, Ali Akbar Mehta will not be joining us, unfortunately, but he will rejoin the conversations in October. And I would like also to welcome our guest, Sara Kutchesfahani, who is joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you, and it will be great to be able to discuss this such relevant topics with you. And thank you to all the participants who have already joined and the ones that are still joining the conversation. Just as a brief context, because some people might have been in the last three conversations, but some might not. Echo Effect, Conversations on War and Environment is a program funded by the Nordic Culture Fund, who gave the Globus Upstart grant to Artists with Evidence in 2024. So we're having a series of six conversations, mostly online. We'll have a hybrid conversation too, where we're tackling not so easy topics at times that connect with war and environment and how it manifests in our daily lives too. And we've had topics, for example, the last conversation was on fermentation, so maybe not so expected topics might arise every now and then. And yeah, today we are really diving deep into nuclear weapons and the importance of disarmament, and especially for our future, and not just human future, but also beyond human and ecosystems futures. Who are we behind this? So Artists with Evidence, just briefly. My name is Inés Montalbán, and I'm the program director for Artists with Evidence. And I've been curating this series of conversations and moderating them. And Artists with Evidence is a nonprofit organization. We are based in the US. I'm based in Helsinki in Finland. So everyone is in a different time zone here. But Artists with Evidence is an organization that is working and focusing mostly on art science. And a lot of our programs have been in relation to climate change, the climate urgency, and many topics. So we've been having programs on climate and death, and war and environment is a very strong line in our program. And we're hoping to develop further the nuclear threat and in response to the nuclear threat. So before we start, I would also like to announce that we now have a podcast. So you can find the AWE podcast on different platforms, and Mathilde will add the links on the chat to rss.com and Spotify. So you can find us in different platforms. And what we are doing is adding the audio versions of these conversations to the podcast too. So I guess it makes it easier a lot of times to just listen and not necessarily see. And all these conversations are anyway on our YouTube channel, that we can also add a link to the chat here. But yeah, just briefly about Sara Kuchesfahani, I'm not going to introduce her as I usually don't introduce the guests very formally, but she's the director of programs at Plowshares, and we'll also add the link to Plowshares so you can take a look. And yeah, we'll together explore like how this nuclear disarmament and the looming dangers of climate change are not just separate crises, but are really intricately intertwined. So, and kind of going into how does the fight to end nuclear threats align with broader efforts to protect our planet from the consequences of war. So to kind of kick off the conversation, I'm gonna address Sara at first. Given that we're living in this time, there's, I think, an estimate of around 13,000 nuclear warheads in existence. I'm sure this number might be even kind of raising at present time, but this destructive potential is really threatening not just like human life, but also the planet's ability to sustain its own ecosystems. So my question, I think, to kind of open up, and it's fine if you also give a little bit of context about Plowshares and where what kind of action Plowshares is taking, but why is this threat of nuclear weapons more urgent now than ever, especially in light of this escalating global conflicts and environmental degradation? So I think that would be kind of a a way to start this.
A very easy way to start, right? No, I'm just joking, but thank you so much for the invitation, Ines. I'm delighted to be here with you all today. And it's not lost on me that the date today is a very significant day, because the September 28th is the International Day for the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. And so if you did that by design, that's amazing. It worked out very nicely. But so this is a very poignant day to be talking about what we are talking about today. So hello, everybody. As Ina said, I'm Sara Kuchesfahani. I'm the director of programs at Plowshares, and I'm calling in from Washington, D.C. I just want to say a few words about who we are and then set the stage. And then, of course, I'll answer the question that Ines posed. So my job at Plowshares entails managing our foundation's grant-making budget, and I'm very privileged to lead a team of three exceptional program officers and associates. Some of you may already know we are a public foundation, and we're based in the United States, and we have offices in San Francisco and also here in Washington, D.C. And as a public foundation, that means we have to raise the money in order to spend it through our grant making. We are the largest foundation singularly focused on reducing the dangers posed by nuclear weapons. And through our grant making, we grow and amplify the impact of the most effective advocates and organizations in the world through critical funding support. Specifically, we fund organizations and people who drive policies and activities that help eliminate nuclear threats or address regional conflicts and or create a more stronger and resilient nuclear risk reduction field, building new partnerships with intersecting issues such as climate change, and of course, the list is endless, and supporting transformational thinking and activities. But what I want to say, I mean, we are talking about a very kind of, you know, dark subject matter. you might be surprised to hear that only a tiny fraction of philanthropic funding goes towards peace and security writ large, and especially so, smaller, if you can imagine, towards the work that we do, towards stopping the spread of nuclear weapons such that we can eventually eliminate them. So while the risks and threats to international security are seemingly rising, the philanthropic money going towards these issues are quite frankly dwindling. So let me kind of set the nuclear scene, as Ina's kind of asked that I do. You know, today we are in 2024 and we have 9 countries around the world who have nuclear weapons. And you might already know this, but in case there are some in the audience that don't, the 9 include the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, China, India, Israel, Pakistan, and North Korea. And what's interesting to note about these 9 countries is that all 9 are actually led by men, which means our entire security, specifically the security of the planet, is beholden to these 9 leaders. And, you know, if I can indulge a little bit in kind of like some historical kind of, history, you know, it hasn't always been the case where it's always been men at the helm. We've had Margaret Thatcher, we had Theresa May, and then we had Liz Truss for all but, 40 days in the United Kingdom. And then there was Indira Gandhi in India and Golda Meir in Israel. But what I want to flag about these 9 countries is that, A, not only are they not all democracies, but as you can tell from the geographic representation or distribution, they're scattered all over the world. And in fact, the only part of the world that doesn't have a nuclear weapon state is the Southern Hemisphere. And where it all began, it began with a scientific project called the Manhattan Project, which was led for and paid but for by the United States. But what's quite fascinating about the Manhattan Project is the international reach or the international composition of the scientists. You had scientists from all over the world that were part of this scientific endeavor. And why I think this is really important to emphasize is because it really speaks to the nature of the truly global problem. It was a global science project, and it still has global security ramifications 79 plus years later. Now, as far as the environmental consequences are concerned, or more specifically, why should, and I think there's a question in the Q&A from Angela Kellett, you know, what is the one thing people need to know about nuclear weapons? Why is it so important? Well, first of all, I think the first thing to note is, you know, people need to be aware that these weapons still exist. You know, there's a huge lack of awareness on this issue. Many people feel like, oh, because the Cold War ended, so too did the possession of nuclear weapons. But that's not true. We still live in a world with many, many nuclear weapons. And Ines, I think the figure that you cited was the most accurate that we are aware of. But not only do we have these weapons, but, you know, as you alluded to, Ines, these weapons, there's an enormous human cost associated of nuclear weapons, whether it's through their testing, whether it's through their possession, or, of course, through their use. And, of course, the environmental consequences of nuclear weapons cannot be overlooked. You know, for context, we've had, even though we have 9 nuclear states, we've had 8 nations that have actually tested nuclear weapons. And I'm going to get a little bit wonky here because this is quite fascinating. We've had 2,056 nuclear test explosions at test sites around the world. And 2 shocking facts I want to bring to your attention here is, first of all, half the number of this total number of nuclear weapons tests was actually conducted by 1 country alone. The United States conducted at least 1,030 tests, which is more than the number of tests done by all the other 7 nuclear testing countries combined. Fact number 1. The second fact, and I think this is really important to note because this is how, you know, the public can be motivated to do something, none of the tests that took place took anywhere near the state's capital city. So, and in some countries, none of these tests even took place in their own countries. So you didn't see any US tests conducted in the nation's capital in Washington, DC. You did not see any British tests taking place in London, Paris, Moscow, Beijing. I can keep going. But what is so shocking about this, and this speaks to kind of, you know, the colonial legacy, if you will, of nuclear weapons, these explosions took place mainly on the lands of indigenous people. And the effects of those tests are still felt today, again, almost 80 years since the advent of the nuclear weapons. know, we can, I can spend more time talking about this, but I think, you know, the environmental degradation or the environmental kind of, you know, damage inflicted by these nuclear weapons, you cannot overlook them, you cannot overstate them. But then, of course, there's also the human cost associated. You know, there is the state of New Mexico here in the United States. This was a place where there were, you know, many, many downwinders. In other words, people that were living kind of who got the effects of the radiation from the tests, if you will. There are families, four or five generations of whom are still dealing or still combating cancer as a result of these tests. And I just want to make it clear that, you know, yes, the testing is kind of done for now. There is talk about maybe revitalizing testing, but those human effects, the human costs, the cost to the environment are still very much felt today. Let me stop there because I don't want this to be a lecture.
That was a really great kind of wrap up of like this, the state of things, but I'm curious as where to all these efforts with disarmament and non-proliferation, all these efforts, where do they stand now? Where do these treaties and all these kind of international agreements, like what's their role and where do they stand at the moment in light of these events that you were just describing?
So this is an excellent question, Ines. And I mean, I don't want to pretend that everything is okay and things are working fine, because it's not. You know, yes, we have one of the most widely signed international treaties called the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, abbreviated to the NPT. You have 189 countries signatory to this treaty, including five of the nuclear weapon states, the UN Security Council, the permanent five, essentially, the US, Russia, China, France, and the United Kingdom. And we have this treaty, and the treaty has been in existence since 1970. But if you look at the history of this treaty, the way in which it was kind of negotiated, the way in which it was agreed upon, it was a very unfair bargain. And what I mean by that is because essentially all the other non-nuclear weapon states that signed on to this treaty did so with a promise that, you know, we will never seek to acquire nuclear weapons. But you, the nuclear weapon states, you're going to help us acquire the peaceful nuclear energy programs. And the kind of the bargain, if you will, was that the five nuclear weapon states was like, yes, and while you agree to never pursue a nuclear weapons test, we will somehow someday work towards disarmament. So it's a very loose bargain, if you will, and it's kind of set up this very unfair order, if you will, within the nuclear kind of, you know, system. But I am one of the few people in my field that actually very much appreciates the strength of the NPT, because one thing, well, there's many things that they did that has been successful. But one thing I do want to spend a little bit of time on today, because it is so important and it's so underappreciated and underexplored, is that Article 7 of the NPT calls for the creation of what's described as nuclear weapon-free zones. These are areas around the world that are essentially protected against the use, storage, and testing of nuclear weapons. And again, if you look at your map, the entire Southern Hemisphere, which is a huge proportion of the world, is all protected. A nuclear weapon free zone. And that is something that I don't think we can forget. That is something that I don't think we can acknowledge. You know, there is an argument to be made, were they created because of the NPT? No, not particularly, but it's something that is codified in the NPT. And again, if you look at your map, you know, the only parts of the world where are nuclear weapons, so it's pretty much in the Northern Hemisphere, that is where, you know, we don't have that protection. We do not have the nuclear weapon free zones. And so I want to remind us that, you know, nuclear weapon free zones are a very, very strong asset to the non-proliferation regime. And again, you know, this is something that quite frankly protects the entire Southern Hemisphere, not only from storing, but also testing and of course use. And just a quick, like, let me just keep going wonky on this. And that is, you know, the nuclear weapon free zones, yes, they're all agreed to by the regions of the Southern Hemisphere. But what's truly fascinating about this piece of this law or this agreement is that all the nuclear weapon states have also signed protocols to these nuclear weapon free zones, which means that they too are prohibited from testing, storing, and using their nuclear weapons. So that is, you know, a really, really positive asset to the NPT. Another kind of, you know, tool that we have in our nuclear disarmament toolbox, if you will, is what we bilateral arms control treaties. Now, these were very prominent towards the end of the Cold War because these were treaties agreed to by the two major nuclear powers, the US and the USSR. And as much as they were a very helpful instrument in kind of getting America and the Soviet Union to reduce their nuclear stockpile, I hate to share this with you, there's only one remaining arms control bilateral treaty in standing between the US and Russia called the New START Treaty. And if that's not depressing enough, this treaty is set to expire at the end of February 2025. And so, you know, the way in which situations are between the US and Russia right now, I mean, I'd like to hope that there's, you know, hope for an extension, but this is the last standing bilateral arms control treaty that we have between the two major nuclear powers. Two more quick things I want to talk about as far as disarmament and non-proliferation efforts. One is, and this is kind of sad because, you know, it didn't really work in the end, but at the time it was hugely successful. And that was the Iran nuclear deal, right? The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That was an agreement signed between the US, Iran, and the EU plus three. And this was huge. This was a huge undertaking on behalf of all the governments involved, especially the US and Iran. I don't think I need to tell anyone in the audience about that fraught relationship. And this was really a sign of, wow, this is how we can maybe get somewhere with diplomacy. But again, I don't need to remind you all of what happened, because when President Trump became the president, basically he ripped up the JCPOA, and we're kind of like, you know, 10 years back behind from where we could have been. And then the final international effort that's worth commenting on, but, you know, with caution, is what's called the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It's short for the TPNW. This is a very commendable effort by many, many countries all over the world. And it's essentially an international effort to basically illegal, make the use of nuclear weapons or even the possession of nuclear weapons illegal. But the problem with this treaty, and as much as I commend the efforts of the organizers and the countries who are signatories to it, none of the nuclear weapon states are party to this treaty. None of the nuclear weapon states go to any of the, you know, the UN fora discussions that take place. NGO participants from countries, NGOs will go there. But when a nuclear weapon state government is like, I'm not interested, one has to question the viability, or quite frankly, the feasibility of an international treaty such as the TPNW from kind of, you know, making anything happen. And I'm not trying to sound dismissive of the treaty. I think it's a very, very laudable and commendable effort. And it's very encouraging to see how, again, the issue of nuclear weapons, many, many small countries have been like mobilized to get behind such a thing. But it's very hard to kind of, you know, how do we get to this total elimination when none of the existing nuclear weapon states are signatory or even, quite frankly, take this treaty, take this initiative seriously?
Yeah, and it feels a bit like there's a certain degree of obscurity that comes with certain governments too. So that also kind of influences like how things are perceived and how the public awareness of this issue is kind of portrayed. And of course, like, while nuclear disarmament is really a critical goal that we can all agree on, we're also kind of grappling with this existential threat of climate change. And so all these phenomena that we keep seeing, like the rising global temperatures, extreme weather events that have been devastating in different ways all over the world. And we've seen that like in the last couple of months, very intensely. All this environmental damage that can be caused by nuclear weapons testing, like you're referring to, like all these testing grounds, and what are these kind of exclusion zones that people are also very much not aware of. They are also exacerbating, of course, this problem. So kind of to pull Colin already into the conversation, we've been in other previous conversations very much talking about resources scarcity And in this case, like, and if we could explore like how these two crises, the nuclear disarmament and climate change, how can we explore this particularly in terms of environmental impacts and the resources that are allocated to each? So maybe if Colin, you'd like to address this topic, you know, kind of climate change as a bit of a threat multiplier, increasing risks of conflict and resource scarcity that we've discussed so much, and migration, for example.
I'm going to take it to a slightly different place, if I may, Ines. it's provoked by what Sarah's saying. I'm going to start with philanthropy and move from there. But what Sarah said about philanthropy is true of any social justice philanthropy that might work from the experience of people who are greatest risk or pay the highest price, whether it be income inequality, whether it be climate risk or war risk. The money that goes to people who can, in fact, have resources on the ground, human community resources to defend themselves against risk, is minimal. Foundations are top down. They are agents of capital by and large, and they are in the thrall of the debt weapons complex. They earn their money that way, and they spend their money in obeisance to it, whether they realize it or not. So that's one piece that's important to understand, because I don't think we can see serious change in any of the polycrises that we face unless there's mobilized movement capacity on the part of peoples around the world. And that capacity is not likely to be funded by philanthropy. It has to be sui generis, and it's very difficult to organize. There was a moment in the 1980s when the Freeze movement stood against weapons proliferation, nuclear weapons proliferation. And it was unique in that it was institution by institution, constituency group by constituency group, doctors against for the freeze, philanthropy for the freeze, nurses for the freeze. It didn't rest on professional community organizing. It didn't rest on professional politicians, but it occurred at a time when the anti-apartheid movement was strong and the civil rights movement had not yet peaked in the United States. And the women's movement was powerful, and the environmental movement had begun to grow. So it was housed in the epoch of movements that had responsive governments in the West. Governments were committed to the rule of law, treaties made sense, and there was a belief you could accomplish through treaty in a regulated coalition of societies. We're beyond belief, I think, that treaties and the rule of law is held sacrosanctly by most of the countries that Sarah mentioned. They're all at risk. Movements tend to be on the right now rather than on the progressive side of the ledger. And those movements are more and more likely to feel desperate, alienated, blaming, and ready to use a phallic presence to actually declare their presence in the world. And remember, those weapons are highly phallic. There's nothing accidental about that. It's a phallic intervention into the security of the world. So when Sarah was talking about male leadership, that's significant. It's significant in terms of world politics. Even when you have women leaders, the culture created they have to lead in is a male inherited culture. So it's extremely difficult to think about movements that can be supported and grown in relation to this issue and other issues. Another layer I'd like to just name is that weapons themselves, look what's happened in Gaza, look what's happened in the Ukraine border. Weapons themselves numb us to the costs to human life. The more we are numbed to value human, against loving human life, we are more at risk of nuclear disaster, because the numbing applies across the board. It's how we allow poverty to grow at extreme levels. It's how we use weapons of non-mass destruction, misnamed, they're all weapons of mass destruction, destroying whole peoples and destroying land for generations. So if we're numb to that, we are not likely to build movements against issues that are more immediately at risking our existence, but they all put our existence at risk. So they're layered and they're interwoven, and the psychology of that in the end comes down to the building of movements, I think, that we have to actually build movements. How do you do that in this period when they have to be sui generis? I take some hope in the Harris campaign here in the United States, in that the way constituency groups are declaring support is, as I say, sui generis. It's not funded. It's not politically mobilized. It's people growing their own expression of discontent and hope. And that's what the freeze movement was. And that's a sign of hope, I think. Today there was, and I'm jumping around a little bit more, and I won't go on for long about this, but Putin said today, basically threatened today to reinterpret the existing nuclear treaty. What he said was he will interpret, or he's threatening to interpret, that any country that is a nuclear country that supports a non-nuclear country will be regarded by Russia as a shared enemy. So that the US support for Ukraine would, by that formula, serve as a declaration of nuclear war. That is a new level of risk that occurred just now. And again, it's about the decline of the respect for the rule of law and for shared regulation of any arena of our lives. And we see it everywhere. I'll just say one other thing about it. The Bretton Woods agreements made debt the organizer of imperial power. And the nature of debt is what's impoverished countries. It's what has created climate disaster in those countries through the ownership of their resources by extracting countries. So we have a complex here that has to be unwoven, and it's very difficult to do it. I'm going to jump to one last thing here because it's at a different level and connects the art to the science and policy of this. I wrote a play 10 years ago about a man in the 1960s who had been the pilot that navigated the plane that declared that it was the time to drop the bomb on Hiroshima.
Yeah.
His name was Claude Ethely. And he was highly regarded as a hero because he called the moment. And he came home to be honored and had a moment of crisis. And he ended up robbing grocery stores to raise money to send to the orphans in Hiroshima who had lost their families and lost their skins very often through the nuclear explosion. And I tried to tell his story. And I mention it here only because it's the personal story. It takes us personally to reject this level, not only of risk, but of assault on other humans. That we have to be offended by the assault on other humans to be able to manage this crisis.
Yeah. Well, if I may, Enes, I want to carry on what Colin is saying, because Colin, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think you've really touched on that really important aspect, the storytelling aspect and the human stories. Because in my field, we are so fixated on jargon, on words that quite frankly don't make any sense, on the minutiae of the money, not how much is being spent and the yield. And, you know, I have a PhD in this issue and we say things like strategic stability. I don't even know what that means. And so, and I feel like, honestly, that is part of why we are not getting more people interested or involved, because it's a highly technical by design issue. And so one of the things that you said that really struck me, first of all, I really want to read your play. So I'm going to have to get the title from you, because I'd love, that sounds like a fascinating play. And I really appreciate you writing it. But let's go way even further. Well, actually not further, like a few months later, when John Hersey, the American journalist, actually was able to get into Hiroshima 1 year after the bombing and was able to interview 6 survivors. This is a story, or these are 6 stories of 6 different individuals who happened to be in Hiroshima, where the New Yorker devoted its entire issue to this story. And these are the kinds of stories that, quite frankly, we don't have enough of. These are the kinds of stories, like, I mean, one of the things I love to kind of, you know, inspire my students is, you know, you read Hiroshima, you give this book to someone who thinks nuclear weapons are the best thing since sliced bread, and I guarantee you they can't walk away from reading that book and not be moved. And so this might be a crazy idea, but, like, you know, we work here in Washington, D.C. What if we were to give a copy of Hiroshima to every single congressman and woman? You know, 500, I mean, I just can't imagine people not being moved by this. And so when you talk about the role of art and science, it is crucial. You know, we as nuclear experts, however you want to kind of conceptualize that, we need other thinking. We need creative thinking. This is such a multidisciplinary issue and it affects each and every one of us, irrespective of whether you're a PhD or a diplomat or an engineer or a scientist. We need that creative thinking. And one thing we have, which I'm very excited about, you know, we have the doomsday clock, right? This very unique, iconic clock put on by one of our grantees, actually, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, where every year they kind of calculate how closer we are to, like, the end of civilization as we know it. This is such an iconic clock, and this is a clock that was pioneered by an artist because she was so, like, moved by this issue and was like, this is not just a technical issue, this is not just a scientific issue. But at the same time, I don't want to, of course, you know, be disrespectful to the science and the scientists. You know, we are sitting here saying we need disarmament, but I'm a political scientist. How on earth am I going to figure out what that looks like and how that's going to be? I need that scientific input. And so I feel like, you know, we cannot decouple art from science. It's such an important kind of combination. And one thing I also want to say, as far as, like, science is concerned, I mean, let's not forget that, you know, the role of scientists became that much more important in the policy process since the advent of nuclear weapons. You never had scientists part of the policy discussions. And so there's something to be said about, you know, talking to scientists about the moral, about the ethical implications of testing of nuclear weapons research. And, you know, kind of story within a story, I used to work at the Nuclear Weapons Laboratory here in the United States, Los Alamos National Laboratory. And what was so fascinating, well, first of all, I was the only political scientist. People were like, why are you here? Which was very interesting. But what was fascinating for me in the 2.5 years that I spent there was I was given some money to go and teach at New Mexico Tech, which was an engineering school in the state of New Mexico, to these aspiring nuclear weapons designers, nuclear weapons scientists, the moral and ethical considerations of what it means to basically go and pursue this path. And I think, you know, NNSA, the National Nuclear Security Administration that funded this, I don't think they kind of appreciated what happened, because a lot of these aspiring nuclear weapons designers are like, oh, we don't want to do this anymore. Like, how can we help to kind of not do that? And so I just want to say that, you know, yes, the science is very important, but when you are studying this issue, when you are wanting to become an engineer, a physicist for the kind of creation of nuclear weapons, the designing, I think we have to do a better job at kind of talking about the human costs, the ethical considerations, and the moral implications of what this might mean. So I just wanted to give you a huge plus one, Colin, because I feel like what you said was 100% accurate. And again, just remind people that this combination, like art and science, you can't get a better kind of, you know, mix, or you need the both of them so much in this space. Sorry,
Ines. No, I think that's like one of the key aspects of these conversations, is also to highlight how these collaborations, these art science collaborations, can really foster dialogue and influencing even public opinion, policy.
Ines, let me just say in response to what Sarah said, I really appreciate that. There was a moment in the 1980s where Boston, I think Boston was the only city that did it, but declared itself a sister city with Hiroshima.
Yeah.
They had annual events in which people, the two mayors hosted events. The man that organized it was a cellist. It's dissipated. But that idea of sister cities with other, finding cities in other countries, not just Hiroshima, but countries at risk, that's a model for allowing art and science to come together, because you can have panels, you can distribute Hershey's book, you can have movies, you can have celebrities, you can have citizens panels, but it's a vehicle for actually conveying the science and the morality to the local level, initiated at the local level. So I was very impressed by it then. I was sorry it didn't grow, and it may be something that can be helped to grow again.
Yeah.
I would like to make a little provocation in that, many people feel that the nuclear disarmament is an abstract or a geopolitical issue, something that is kind of far removed from our daily life. So thinking about this art science angle or other tools or possibilities, like, how do we make then this issue feel urgent and real for people, and particularly younger generations?
This is my favorite question, Ines, and I'm so grateful. I mean, I like all your questions, but this in particular, because it's like, why should I care? How does this matter? How does this affect me? And I think I have some potential considerations, right? First of all, I say this as someone that has devoted her entire career to kind of stopping the spread of nuclear weapons. We cannot just focus on this issue in a vacuum. You cannot just focus on nuclear weapons on their own. This interconnection, the intersections, is so important. And it's quite frankly underexplored. Because if you think about it, every single social, political issue that you might be interested in, there is a connection to the nuclear weapons industry. Climate, environment, economy, health, education. I mean, I can keep going. And one of the things that I really love challenging anyone that asks me, like, why do I do what I do, is I ask them, and maybe we can ask the audience to participate in this too, what is that one policy social issue area that you are so passionate about? Let me, the nuclear expert, and I'm not just one person, there's many of us, let us find that connection for you, because you will be surprised how this issue intersects with everything. And I say this and I get very passionate about it, because we all have a part to play in this. Everyone has a part to play in this nuclear story. And so what I'd love to ask you all to do is, you know, challenge your friends, challenge your families, your coworkers, your neighbors. If you're flying a plane, well, actually, maybe you don't want to talk about nuclear weapons on a plane, but like, ask them to bring you that social political issue that they really care about, and we can find that nuclear connection. So that's number one. We have to stop thinking that this is a one and only type issue that's so closed and so insular. It connects everything to everybody, number one. The second thing that I am also extremely passionate about is we have to remind ourselves that this is an international security problem. This is a global problem. We have to stop thinking that, oh, it's just the US that has to deal with it, or just the Russians have to deal with it. Quite frankly, this is not a nuclear weapon state only issue. This is an issue that affects planetary security, whether it's human security, whether it's the environment. It's each and every one of us, every single country is impacted by these weapons. So that's number two. And I think the third thing, and this is kind of like related, so not only the global aspect, remember the whole project, the whole Manhattan Project was purely global, and the implications to global security continues. So if we remember that it's global, that it's an issue that affects each and all, every one of us, if we remember that there's interconnections with everything, I think the more we can think through these lenses of international intersectionality, then we get a little bit closer to what we mean when we talk about security. Because the way in which the world is kind of constructed, security means one thing to the global nuclear powers. And I guarantee you that the way in which nuclear weapon states think about security is vastly different from how pretty much all the other non-nuclear weapon states view security. So how might we get to a more global understanding of what we mean by security? Mm-hmm. Is by really looking at this issue through a truly global international perspective. And when we do that, and when we tease out those interconnections that nuclear weapons enjoy with, like I said, every other political social issue, I firmly believe that we could then push that needle on getting closer to a world without nuclear weapons. And I do want to just say one thing about the role of youth, because I think that's so, so important. And I don't say this as someone who's in their mid-40s, but when I look at those in Generation Z, Gen Z, and I say this from experience, I have a 20-year-old niece and a 15-year-old nephew who are both in London, their reach to people across the world of their same age, whether it's through Twitch, whether it's through other social media platforms, the fact that they have so much humility in understanding there are so many things that they don't know. I mean, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. My hope, the reason why I keep doing this work is because of their futures, because they are going to get it right. We failed them. My parents failed them. My grandparents failed them. And because the young people of today, and I know young is such an all-encompassing word, but they are so motivated by social injustices. They are so motivated by learning about this interconnected world that we live in. And I don't mean just as far as issues are concerned, but global issues. They give me that hope. They give me that inspiration that I firmly believe the more we can get young people to know about this and how do we do this? Well, you know what? We start talking about this issue in the school, in a classroom. You shouldn't have to pay so much money to go learn about it in a postgraduate, you know, setting. How can we introduce this issue in syllabi across the world to young people so that they already know about this issue? And, you know, I feel that they can kind of do something. Okay, sorry, I got so animated. I've got no energy left. I really believe in that. So anyway.
No, and I think you touched the really key point.
Can I piggyback that?
Yeah, go ahead.
So a couple of things. I think movements are generally generated and led by young people.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King was 26. Jefferson was in his 20s, declarations. So movements are led by young people. So the drive to movement, the need to sponsor movement is really important. We're in a point now in the United States where in many schools, particularly in the South, well, you can't even talk about sex. You won't be able to talk about nuclear weapons.
Right.
But one's got to challenge the politics as it stands. And so I want to say the other side of what Sarah's saying about all the multi-issues that feed back into nuclear. Nuclear feeds back into those too. It's a two-way deal. So in some sense, you have to make progress on the others to open the space to deal with the nuclear, because it is the go-to place. Weapons are the go-to place. Guns are the go-to place for the alienated. It's an expression of power when you don't have any. It's the kind of legendary people voting against their own interests. Unless their interests can be served as they experience their interest, they are not going to leave the space open to challenge the power structure that gives them some sense of power. I mean, America has lost every war since World War II, every single war, longstanding wars. That's had an impact on young people in America. They're playing video games that are all about destruction.
Yeah.
This is an expression of personal power when one doesn't have personal power. So we have to start addressing the local politics of people's experience to open up the space to deal with these other issues that are terribly threatening, but don't feel as threatening. I'll give you one little anecdote. It's an old story back in the 80s when this stuff was live previously. My board had an African-American member on the board, and we were moving toward joining the nuclear freeze philanthropy world and make grants in the area. We actually were colleagues with Plowshares in its early days. He opposed it. And he opposed it not because he was blasé about the risk of nuclear war. He was saying, my people in Alabama and in Georgia face death every day just going to work and going to school. Why should our money be spent on that global hypothetical when we're not trying to solve the problem of the people on the ground who suffer? And I don't think it's one or the other, but I think it can be easily experienced as one or the other. And our job, I think, is to make it clear that we care about both. They are not only interrelated, they're solvable only if we address the quality of life of people whose planet is at risk, but their own lives are also at risk on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think this ties really interestingly with one one topic that we've addressed in a few of our conversations, which is language and how much language matters. And so kind of reframing security, you know, not looking at it just from this military, under this military light. We just, Artists with Evidence with some partners, we just had a last week, a climate security festival. And that's something that comes up quite often. Like, what does it mean, this word, this concept, and how do we define the borders in which it's applied, right? So I think that both of you have like raised like this very interesting point of view towards what security means at a global, also at a personal scale, as an environmental aspect. So I'm thinking we actually had a couple of polls. We sometimes do polls with our audience just kind of to test a little the feel in the audience. And we had one that I think kind of fits nicely here. So I'll ask Mathilde to launch it. And so basically in this poll, we are asking, how can interdisciplinary approaches, art, science, activism, culture most effectively contribute to disarmament and climate action? And you need to choose one. So there, we never give more than one option. So you kind of need to choose the one you think it's the most, your first choice. So we have raising public awareness, or by shaping policy discussions, creating emotional connections, or challenging dominant narratives. And yeah, I think that this will give us like kind of an insight from where the participants that we have today are coming from. And it's interesting that it's kind of like in between creating emotional connections and challenging dominant narratives, which kind of reflects a bit of what we were discussing and how much how powerful it can be that there is this collaboration and how, you know, these narratives can also be changed at a certain level of like a community level almost. So I think that most people have answered. So maybe I will end the poll. We have the kind of almost a tie, but a bit more people actually chose challenging dominant narratives. So this will, I will share the results. And you can see there was still someone who went with raising public awareness, which a lot of times kind of is very tightly connected with the other two, because you brought up a term, the storytelling, Sara, and I think that kind of is what can bring also that awareness, right? Mm-hmm. And I can just remove this. So yeah, I think that this power of collaboration and art science is something that we've been looking at also with Artists with Evidence and Echo Effect, for example. It's really also about a collaboration. It's actually the project behind these conversations is actually a collaboration between Colin and Ali, where we want to include Colin's poetry and Ali. Ali has a super interesting archive of imagery and footage of violence. It's called the Purgatory Archive. And it's got, I think it's around 40,000 entries at the moment. And the thing that first fascinated me about this project of his is that he doesn't define violence in a single way. So violence is a spectrum, right? And so within these videos that he includes in the archive, he also has peaceful videos. So for example, like bottom of the ocean, things like that. So, and that is really interesting because you can only understand violence if you understand peace. So it's also a spectrum there. And I think this was what kind of first drew me to his work. And then we started discussing about like how we can could like recombine both of Ali and Colin's work and use AI to do this, which would bring us to another level of discussions on AI and looking at it from a critical point of view, but still really to understand like how recombining this level, what would be a different interpretation of these works. So yeah, do you have any comments about like what was the outcome from this poll? Or was
I went to the sum saying, I'm not sure it fits that question exactly, but maybe it does, but about the Ali connection and Sarah's very powerful point about the interconnectedness. one of the almost two obvious connections between climate and nuclear weaponry and public health is nuclear power.
Yeah.
And it's shocking in a way that Three Mile Island is being regenerated with nuclear power in order to power AI.
Mm.
Three Mile Island. Probably the worst disaster America has experienced around nuclear. So they are deeply connected, but separating nuclear power from nuclear war and nuclear weapons is probably mistaken, even though it looks like nuclear is a cheap way out of the climate problem. But it's not cheap. And it builds a kind of benign quality, gives a benign hubris to nuclear energy. It needs to be thought about carefully and understood very well. And the labor that goes into that puts usually poor people at great risk because they're the ones doing the work, the rebuilding. And more children. I mean, talking about youth, I mean, we've got 14 or 16 states that are in the process of trying to repeal their child labor protections. So you have 12-year-old kids on roofs. You have 12-year-olds in poultry kill rooms. Cleaning them up at night with dangerous machinery. So who gets to work on the reactivation of those plants is also a critical question. So they're interrelated. So climate, human life, and weapons has a clear connection in this drive now to nuclear power.
Yeah. And I think, Colin, you raise, you know, another excellent point. It's like, you know, who are the people that have to do that work? They are the people who are the most impacted by the work, but they are the people most often ignored from decision making, right? And it's like, imagine if we were to invite impacted communities to kind of participate in these policy discussions. I don't think we would continue the policies that we are working towards, because how would we, you know? And so, but to answer your question, Ines, which I think is a really, well, it wasn't really a question. You wanted us to comment on what you had said. I think there's something very powerful in what you shared with Ali's work as far as kind of, you know, thinking about it through the lens of peace. That is something that, you know, in my almost 20 plus years of working in this field, I very seldom use the word peace. And it's like, how can we talk? And I find that such a striking reminder that everything that we're doing is in the interest of international peace and security. And I think, you know, one way to kind of de-technolize or de-jargonize this kind of work is reminding everybody we are doing this for peace, in pursuit of peace. And I think, you know, because, you know, there is that argument, which of course I don't buy, that nuclear weapons are a source of peace. I mean, the fact that this is a narrative that gets espoused and people are like, oh yeah, that's right. It's just, it's beyond my comprehension, because how can something so destructive?
It's the language of security again,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And I think what you said is so poignant. Like, you know, it's all about the language, it's all about the terminology. And if we think about it in the framework of like peace and security, justice and equity, you know, that is another way of kind of attracting more people into this field, into this issue, because that's what we want, that's what we strive for. So I want to thank you, Ines, for kind of, you know, introducing Ali's work and that reminder that the word peace is so powerful and so important.
You have it in your name, right? Plowshares is synonym for peace, right? Swords into plowshares. That's exactly the point.
but it's that connection though, isn't it? Like, yes. You know, I work at Plowshares. I've worked at Plowshares for over 2 years now. I forget that. And so that was a reminder. It's like, you know, so, but yeah, I think the words, the term, and remember the language of war and the language of militarism isn't just English, right? Yeah. I mean, I think every country, every language has that word war, has that word peace. How do we deconstruct that in a way that, you know, makes itself more welcoming, makes itself more accessible so that there is that universal concept, that universal kind of pursuit of peace and justice.
Mm. I would also like to highlight what you mentioned about like the ones that are most affected, that they don't really have a voice in this. And just thinking about this example, I don't know if people are aware of this non-proliferation treaty for fossil fuels. There's an initiative undergoing, and there's 13 nations that have signed this treaty, and they are small nations. Yeah. So they are actually the ones that are already being affected by this. So they are kind of initiating this and hoping that more and bigger or more powerful nations will follow. So that makes me think, like, what are kind of the steps forward with this disarmament and non-proliferation, and are there any lessons from past efforts that we would incorporate into current or upcoming strategies, things that we are kind of looking at in the near future?
So this is another excellent question, Ines, and I'm, again, very grateful that you've asked it. So I have a few, again, considerations. And I think, you know, not to be a pessimist, but to be a realist, first and foremost, the political will has to be there. You know, if the political will is such that we will live and die by our nuclear weapons, it's very difficult to change that. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult. And you asked for kind of past examples. In my PhD research, I looked at Argentina and Brazil, two nuclear aspiring countries. And these governments were very kind of gung-ho about wanting to become, you know, South America's first nuclear weapon state. But that political will was changed by the scientists, by the activists, because it was like, why do we need to do this? So this is a hopeful story. It's like a happy story. So political will has to be there, but I don't think that should be an obstacle or a barrier. It should inspire more of like the grassroots people to kind of, you know, we can change that political will. So number one. The second thing, which I've kind of said ad nauseum, but I'll say it once more, again, spreading this awareness, right? Introducing this issue to people from a really young age, which I know problematic, but it's something that we can think about. The third area where we can make progress towards disarmament is trust, dialogue, and diplomacy. You know, again, these are not just loose terms, but these are terms that have been used that can be applied to successful nuclear stories. Like I said, Argentina and Brazil were two very, they were not enemies, they were just like regional rivals, but it was through their mutual disdain, if you will, of this like unequal order as far as the NPT and who got to have a nuclear weapon and who didn't. It was through that mutual disdain that they were able to create trust. They were able to start, you know, having conversations. They invited each other's scientists to go and inspect their facilities. And of course, with that comes diplomacy. And I'm still a huge proponent of like soft power. And these are the kinds of things that I think can get us to disarmament. You know, the other area to talk about, of course, is like those interconnections. You know, we can speak, and I take your point completely, Colin. It has to be a two-way street. We can't, the nuclear people cannot just expect everyone to show up for us. We have to show up for everybody. It has to be a mutual thing. And the last thing I'll say, which I think Colin really touched upon eloquently, is this notion of civil society and grassroots activism, the movement. That freeze movement was so powerful, but that was in the early 1980s. And yes, it kind of swayed political decision. It helped result in, you know, a dramatic reduction of nuclear weapons between the US and the Soviet Union. It helped, it worked. We haven't had a resurgence. We haven't had a 21st century version of the freeze movement. I mean, we have Greta for climate, but where is Greta for nukes, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like, we need to, how what are the steps towards kind of inspiring that civil society, that kind of movement? So yes, it's all very doom and gloom, but I believe we have some steps that we can take. And like I said, I think it does start at the grassroots level by asking these questions, by challenging our decision-making elites, and by, you know, showing those interconnections and reminding ourselves that, you know, this is one planet, we all share it, and we'd like to have it continued for future generations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I think that we had one poll, the second poll, if we could launch it, because I think you were saying like what where your kind of hopes are, and I'm curious about what people think are the most significant obstacles to achieving this global nuclear disarmament. So we'll launch the poll. I can see. Oh, yeah. So the possible answers, and again, you need to choose one, are the, so what do you think are the most significant obstacle to achieving global nuclear disarmament? And we have geopolitical tensions, lack of public awareness, technological advancements in weaponry, and economic interests. And I can see that the answers are kind of fluctuating a bit between at least the first two and the last options. And once we get like the outcome of what people are thinking that or what they think it's the most significant kind of obstacle, then it keeps totally changing, which is quite interesting. So some yeah, I think that now I can share and poll, and I can share the results with everyone. So the one that got the most votes is actually geopolitical tensions. I don't know if that's like a reflection of like the current times we're in, or if it's something that of course has been a part of human humankind history, but yeah, it's interesting, and I'm kind of curious, like, which one would you two have picked? And you can only choose one, the most significant obstacle. What would that be for you?
For me, or for Colin, or for both?
For both. Yeah, you can go.
Colin, ahead. You go first. I feel like I've totally dominated this conversation, so please go
no,
first.
No.
I don't think that's true. No, it's been great. You know, I'm not going to choose. I'm going to say that the tomorrow morning, today, geopolitical tensions are putting us at enormous risk, but the solutions are likely to be much more multidimensional. Pushing back from the brink may be an international diplomatic moment, but it won't solve the problem.
Yeah, I kind of agree. And I feel like, you know, it's so hard to pick one of the four, because I feel like they all have a role to play. And I think to Colin's point, it really depends what day it is. It depends, you know, but also I think it really depends on where in the world you are right now, right? So, and I think the perspective is, of course, very important. And I think, you know, the distribution of the answers based on where people might be would also be quite fascinating to kind of explore, because again, this goes back to my point about security for one doesn't necessarily mean the same for someone else. And so it's also that, so the notion of perspective and the notion of kind of, you know, your geography, I think is really, really important in issues such as this.
Yeah, I think that, go ahead.
I was just gonna quote Orwell, you know, peace is not war.
Yeah.
And so if we're after peace, we have to stop war.
And of course, as we think about
massive rejection of war. That's of course pie in the sky at the moment, but it is a fact. Peace is not war, but we keep justifying war in pursuit of peace.
It's not
accurate. It's a false god.
Yeah, we're back to the semantics of it, right? I think as we think about the future, it's really clear that these traditional notions of security are really rooted in this military might. So they're not they're no longer efficient in addressing like the poly crisis that we're facing. So we're kind of needing to find new ways of addressing the issue too. And I wanted to shed a light into like Colin's work too, with so kind of like thinking like, how does your work or your poetry, your social activism contribute, or can contribute, or how do you feel they contribute to reshaping this our understanding of security, and a topic that we've addressed so many times, which is resilience. And we had our second conversation was about resilient narratives. We also tackled a lot of issues with philanthropy and things like that, but kind of how can poetry, social activism then kind of reshape this understanding of security and resilience in your view?
Gosh, well, I'm not sure that I can say that it does, but how might it contribute? There's a Palestinian poet that has a line, says, how do I prevent a poem from becoming a gun? Hmm. The other side of that is where I would go, is that a poem activated with the public is a chance for the public not to be activated to weapons. It is an opportunity for people to experience the truth of their humanity, and it's an opportunity for people to step out of the limits of their own experience. Not necessarily that it will work, but I think that's the goal, to share a moment in the poet's life that where the poet has experienced that phenomenon and invite people in. I think that's the goal. There's a dramatic line in Marlowe's Faust that I would just quote, because I think it speaks to many layers of this, and I hope it will be as expressive for you in hearing it. But in Marlowe's Faust, Faust has signed his soul over to the devil. And he says to Mephistopheles, so now you've got my soul, where is this place called hell that I'm going to? Mm-hmm. And Mephistopheles says, all places are hell that are not heaven. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the goal, for people to experience the possibility of heaven in their lives, and that it's worth grasping, and that short of that, it's disaster. That's the power of poetry, I think, that it invites you into recognizing that morality is not about esoteric choice. It's about living with other human beings well, or destroying each other.
Yeah, Colin has the talent of letting us all speechless every now and then in these conversations, and he hasn't even read a poem yet, but one of his poems yet. But so while we can like digest a little bit of this, there's actually another poll that we could launch to our audience that I'm curious, and that I think will like kind of guide us slowly into kind of a wrap up. But if we can launch the poll, it's asking, in your view, what is the most effective way to achieve nuclear disarmament and address climate change together? And the answers, the possible answers are international treaties and agreements, grassroots movements and public awareness, technological innovation, and art science collaborations. And it's interesting to see like how it's kind of the whole thing opened up with the grassroots movements, which was something that you brought up, Sarah, a while ago. And I think, well, I can see that there's some faith in the international treaties and agreements too. But, and I, again, we always ask people to choose a single option, which I know it's a little hard always, but yeah, we'll let it. Yeah, I think that we've got like a solid major response, and I can share the results with everyone. So I guess the grassroots movements and public awareness are still kind of like at the top, or at least like what is the most effective way that we can. I think from the examples that you've shared, this kind of shows that it's very much like that, through public awareness, which can happen, like you were saying, Sara, at going at a school level also, like with curricula, for example, in education. I think that that can be one of the many threads that we need to kind of weave into this. Yeah, but what would be kind of your, I know that's probably quite hard to give an answer to this, or I can let you choose two options.
Well, I want to comment on the results. I'm so disheartened that not one person thought there was any viability in art and science collaboration. But again, it's a tough job. You're asking people to just pick one, right? Understand. Yeah. And I was kind of encouraged to see that there's still faith in international treaties and agreements. So that was very encouraging to see. But, you know, because you're asking for one, I think obviously I have to say it's the grassroots movement. I mean, I feel like that is really where it can we can see the most positive results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
I'd make a plug on that occasion for the sister cities idea. I mean, I think grassroots movements need a focal point. That's what the Freeze did. You need a focal point, a place where people can gather and build an identity around this. I mean, it's, you know, we're often, I've said before in these conversations, we're faced with the choice very often between a goodwill bonding and a malignant bonding.
Yeah.
And we have to make more and more occasions that invite people into goodwill bonding. Because we need to bond, and weapons of any kind, and nuclear weapons in particular, because of the phallic quality, I think, attracts to a malignant kind of cohesiveness that's ultimately very dangerous, because it's mob behavior around the worst possible value system.
Mm. Yeah, we have a comment from someone, a participant, Tuche Erel, saying that she was tempted to choose art-science collaboration so that artists can influence the future scientists, but could only choose one. So I guess it's more about like where you place like the, you know, the most prominent, like.
Can I just say something about, I'm just reminded, sorry to interrupt you, but interested in sharing with you, Harry Belafonte, who was a friend, would quote Paul Robeson around this particular theme, and I think it's relevant to the art and science thing, around the art side anyway, and probably on the science side too. But Robeson would say that in building movement, you don't want artists, you don't want artists for their celebrity mm-hmm. and their contributions in donations. It's nice to have that. But what you need is activist artists, people who are activists and in their lives are artists, not people who can be invited to a gathering to raise a bit of cash.
Mm.
So nice to use celebrity, but artists need to be activists.
And yeah, and I think it applies to science too. Yes. Yeah, and we see some movements go, you know, like we have the Extinction Rebellion and now we have the Scientist Rebellion. Yeah. So yeah.
But it's an important distinction. It's not just art, it's the artist activist.
Mm. Yeah. And there was one sentence that, or a quote that came up like while I was preparing for this conversation. So Albert Einstein said, "The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything except our ways of thinking."
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of like showing that, you know, in a world where the nuclear weapons are very much present anyway, our conversations and actions today can kind of paved the way for a safer and more secure future. So I would like to kind of ask you both, and it might be a very easy answer for you, or maybe it will be a bit longer answer, but like in this context, you know, of that, you know, in a world that needs narratives of survival and hope, not just of destruction, and Can we like imagine like the futures through storytelling, and can we imagine this world free from nuclear weapons? So kind of what gives you hope in the face of this kind of daunting challenges? So, and
I'll go fast. And so I feel like, I mean, again, it's another really great question, because, you know, we can't just bang our heads against the wall and say, oh, it's all doom and gloom. There's a reason why we do this work, because we know that there's hope. And I will start by saying this gathering in and of itself is like very hopeful, right? You've got obviously people coming because they care, they're interested. So that's one thing. As I mentioned earlier, the Generation Z, and I don't know the generation, is it double A? I don't know how it all works out, but like that generation gives me a ton of hope because of their curiosity and because of their humility. And Ines, you said this as well, you know, the resilience of human beings. I mean, the amount of, you know, destruction and catastrophe that the human race has had to endure, but yet we keep coming back and we keep fighting. I feel like we cannot ignore that. And then the final thing I'll say, which kind of speaks to who I am as a person in the field and the space that I occupy, is one of the things that gives me the greatest hope is like knowing that there is an army, sorry to use militaristic jargon, but there's like a group of people out there who they want nothing better than to upend this current status quo and to give the mic to those who are truly impacted. And I'm going to kind of, you know, one of my colleagues is actually on the call today, Angela Kellett. She's the executive producer of our podcast called Nuke Talk. And one of the greatest gifts she has done as the executive producer of our podcast is she's given the mic to members of impacted communities. And it's not just a performative function, it's because they have stories to tell. And it's probably good that we can't see Angela, because she's probably getting really mad at me that I'm saying all this, but the impact of those stories, the kind of the appreciation that we have as an organization have received, I just feel like, you know, there's so many more stories that we need to hear, and there are so many more stories that we need to tell. And in my mind, that gives me the greatest hope. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I see Angela has been also commenting. She shared even a link of an example of an artist and activist. And please feel free to also add a link to the name of the podcast, because I think everyone would be interested. There's also an interesting example from William Dunn saying that the Finnish Parliament building was sprayed red by activists to protest peat mining, and that it was very impactful. So again, an example of how, you know, people are taking action in matters that affect them directly and profoundly, you know, so.
Yeah,
but Colin, if I would love to hear what gives you hope.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a number of things that give me hope. One is 8 grandchildren. from ages 15 to 2, and when I watch the 15-year-old play with a 2-year-old, I recognize that love, not just trauma, is transferable across generations. That gives me a lot of hope. And people in action, there are people in action all over the world, and I think the challenge for people in action is to be in action lovingly, not simply to be in action to blame and play enemy games. We have to defeat nuclear weapons. We have to defeat capital controls. But that is not to turn the people into enemies. Mm. And I mean that in the most profound sense. That if we replicate the friend enemy syndrome in trying to solve problems, we will simply replicate the syndrome.
Yeah.
So we have to try, as Gandhi said, to live in the world of our activism as though it were the world we want to live in.
I think this would be like a great moment to kindly ask Colin if he had prepared any poem for us today.
I wrote a poem that I thought might be useful or resonant. It's an unusual poem for me in a sense, because it's a very, very simple. Generally, as you know, they're more complex, but this is simple. It's a playoff of listening to Handel's Messiah. So I call it Getting a Handle on Gravity. and handle, as in the name handle. It's all the time, everywhere, people pounding on people. Not all the time, not everywhere, but so much, so often, so bad. So much of the time, in so many places, so many people pounded on, so many people pounding, if not here, there, somewhere, if not everywhere, all the time, all against all, but not all. There are those serving grace, no matter how bad, everywhere, all the time. The fishers throw out lines so baby fish can swing on them, who make the rough places safe, while raindrops continue to fall slower, quite a bit slower than gravity.
Thank you, Colin. It's always a treat to have a poem read by you and written by you and shared here.
Thanks for the
And I think there is, we'll have a little time for some questions. I mean, we've addressed a few of the questions that the participants have asked along the way, but there's one from Roberto Bugliani. What do you think is the role of teachers and educators? I find that bringing testimonies to my classroom is really impactful and makes students more aware and proactive. Am I the only one to notice?
I mean, I think it's an excellent question. And, you know, Roberta, thank you for asking it. I think there's a huge role for teachers and educators, but, you know, it's not fair to ask teachers and educators to kind of learn something that they don't necessarily know. And so, you know, again, there are many people that work in our space that would be so willing and ready to come to your classes and to kind of talk to your students about the work that we do. And we also have connections to impacted communities. And I think hearing that firsthand testimonials, it's so powerful. Again, it goes back to the comment I made about John Hersey's Hiroshima. You know, you can't read that and pretend to not be affected by it. So, Roberta, I don't know where in the world you are, but, you know, we have the gift of Zoom. If there's anything we can do to kind of help, you know, for us to come to your classes virtually or to connect you with people, I'm happy to drop my email address in the chat. Please don't hesitate to reach out and, you know, connect, and anything we can do to bring this issue to your classrooms, we would be very, very happy to reply. I'm just going to put my name thing, my email address in the chat.
Make sure to put it to everyone on the chat. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Teachers are an invaluable resource for so many things. Not just caring for kids, but helping kids understand the humanity of each other. That's probably the key of the storytelling and the testimony. Humanize others. It's so easy for others to be demonized. Mm-hmm. That's the critical step teachers can take, I think, and then content comes in that framework. But the key contribution, I think, is for people to see the humanity in each other, experience the humanity of mm-hmm. each other.
Yeah, I think it's also something we brought up in other conversations, which is identity, and teachers play such a key role when we're growing up, not just as kids, but in college and everything. Like, it's all a kind of an identity building process in a way, so they can influence it too, for the good and for the bad. So it's also always very important to be aware of that and of the context, like where you are and what kind of government you have, what kind of learning curricula you're teaching. So all this, I think, plays very much like different roles, but it's great that also you are, you know, establishing these connections. So like Sara was just offering to come to this place. And I think it's really through collaborations, and it's something that at AWE as a nonprofit, we've been also learning and going through, which is only through collaboration can we like keep moving forward, you know, with other organizations. So it can't be about like fighting for the same funding, or it's much more about collaborating with people that are thinking in the same lines and sharing goals. that we can kind of move forward. Yeah, I think we're kind of running out of time. Of course, if someone still has any question, like burning question, or please share any comments or feedback on how you felt about this conversation. But yeah, I would like to conclude this just thinking at a bit of on what I was saying, that as all these challenges keep intensifying, I think the international community and all its sectors, science, art, diplomacy, activists, everything is gonna play a role, right? So I would like to thank Sara and Colin for sharing your insights today, and a glimpse of what could be possible solutions also for our future, and encourage everyone that's listening to us or that will hear, listen to the recording and then the podcast, so that people also kind of feel engaged, encouraged into taking action in these critical areas. And I'd like to thank again our funders. So the Nordic Culture Fund was giving us the Upstart grant that enables us to share these moments, these conversations with everyone. And we will have a very interesting next guest. Maybe I'll leave it as a bit of a surprise, but we'll be looking into notions of displacement and how you can grow within a scenario of adversity. So we'll have a really, really great guest for the next conversation that will happen in October. So please stay tuned and follow like our social media, Instagram. We have a link tree, the link in bio in our Instagram is always updated with what's next. And feel free to reach out if you find that there is a way that you would like to get engaged also with Artists with Evidence, or get in touch with any of our guests. We'll also be happy to facilitate that. And yeah, it's thank you so much for the nice comments also on the chat right now. And thank you so much, Colin and Sara. I don't know if you want to say any.
I want to thank you very much for the great facilitation and great prep work. And Sara, it's really great to meet you, and really thanks for a great conversation.
Thank you, right back at you. And again, huge thanks to you, Ines, for curating this conversation. And I really did enjoy talking to you, Colin. And like I said, I'm about to go order your play because I really want to read that. So, but thank you so very much.
Thank you so much, everyone in the audience too. And we'll see you again in October.
Bye.
Echo Effect. Conversations on War and Environment is a program funded by the Nordic Culture Fund, who awarded Artists with Evidence with the Globus Upstart grant for 2024.